Good morning. It's good to see everybody. Sorry that Jerry had to go through what he had to go through, so that Justin and I could do the class and speak this morning. But we're glad he's doing better. He looks great, and I know he'll be glad when he can see out of his eye better. Thank you all for being here and for caring about the congregation here and our work here together to be here to support each other, to worship together. It's been a cold week by Florida standards, so hopefully everybody's thawing out from that. We're going to talk about James chapter 1 this morning. And I need to... Somebody... Jim, we hit the light. But I want to look at James chapter 1 in a different way. You know, we need somewhere. Do you find this problem, Jerry? We need somewhere else to move this laptop so you have more room up here to spread your notes out. I never think about it except when I'm up here. But note to John Raines, if you listen to this lesson, please add something onto the podium to put the computer on. Okay. John's at RMC with Greg doing the service there today. I want to look at James in a different way. James is one of those books that's very familiar to us. And James chapter 1, is we talk about trials, but I want to try to look at it from a little different standpoint than we typically do. Just hopefully today will be a lesson that you can just take some practical things home with you about ways that we can help each other better. In James chapter 1, verse 1, and I'm reading from the English Standard, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Some versions read their endurance. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any one of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, and the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower of the grass he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass, its flower falls and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. So much in that chapter, as we've talked about and heard maybe even many lessons or classes about, James chapter 1 and how we're going to handle trials and difficulties. And it's certainly what we all know and what we should know is that these things are going to happen to us. It's not a matter of when. And whether they occur later in life or earlier in life, it really doesn't matter. Once you've gone through real trials, then when you read this, you know exactly what he's talking about. I've said this before, I've led a sheltered life for much of my life and just didn't suffer much. Came from a very well intact family, a very functional family. And so, but when finally later in life that I really encountered some trials, boy, James 1 really meant something to me then. It meant so much. And as we look at James 1, as he just in this overview, as he talks about trials, what we understand is the desire of trials is to do what? It's to perfect us. He says what? Trials produce endurance or perseverance. Those things make us perfect and complete. Look over at Romans chapter 5. It very similar thing. Hold your place in James because we're going to go back there. But in Romans chapter 5, this is how he says, starting in verse 1, Romans 5, verse 1, therefore, since we have been justified by faith and we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through Him, we have also obtained access by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. This hope in the glory of God. More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings. James says, count it all joy when you encounter sufferings. Paul says here in Romans, because of the hope we have through Christ, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame. Very similarly, it says in James 1, verse 12, right? So in Romans, it's trials produce our sufferings, or trials produce endurance. Endurance produces character, and character hope. And back over in James chapter 1, verse 12, blessed is the man who is steadfast under trial, for when he stood the test, he received the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love Him. The ultimate result in both places of trials is what? Make us into the kind of people, give us perseverance, give us endurance, so that we may be perfect, so that our character will be what God wants it to be, so that we can have hope, so that we can have the crown of life. I mean, in verse 12, James makes it very clear, if we don't handle trials right, what's going to happen to us? We're going to lose the crown of life. I mean, this is a big deal. This isn't just how to make your life a little easier here on the earth as we encounter hard times and bad things happen to us. It is in James chapter 1, verse 12, if we stand the test, then we will receive the crown of life. The implication is what? If we don't stand the test, then we're not going to receive the crown of life. So it is, to me, important how I deal with trials in my life. If they're going to come and they're going to be difficult, and I'm going to need what? Well, he tells us what? When we go through trials, I'm going to need wisdom. Why do we need wisdom in trials? What's the idea there? Well, isn't it the idea that I'm not going to always understand? I'm not going to figure it out. I'm going to ask two questions that we all ask, right? Why is it happening to me? Why now? And how long is it going to last? Well, so he says, all right, when we feel that way, when we're going through those things, then we ask God for wisdom. Well, how does God give us that wisdom? Well, there's the sense in which what? We read in His Word, and we get confidence from that, and we get encouragement from it, because the Word of God is telling us things that are true about God. And that gives us some wisdom, and that gives us some hope. But clearly, there's more to it than that. If you've ever been through a trial like that, if you're honest with yourself, and if you've really gone through something that's really been tough, what you will always know and what people will always say is what? I am glad that I had somebody else there to help me through that. If you're married, I'm glad my wife or my husband was there. I'm glad that friend stood beside me. I'm glad I had, and if you're really lucky, I'm glad I had the family of God stand behind me. Because what you say is, I wouldn't have made it through this trial. I wouldn't have made it through this difficulty. I wouldn't have understood what it was all about. I wouldn't have had the wisdom and the faith to continue. It wouldn't have produced in me the character that it did if I didn't have you there helping me. So what we want to do today is look at not how trials affect us, but ask this question, and that is, how can I love you during trial? And how can you love me during trial? How can we learn to show brotherly love to each other when we're going through trials? We almost always look at this and say, well, and we think about, well, when I'm going through this, this is what I struggle with, and this is what's hard for me. So all I did was I asked myself, what do I want when I've gone through these difficult times in my life? When you've gone through these difficult times in your life, what do you want from others? What do we want from each other that's going to get us through that, that's going to help us, that's going to make this work? What do I look for my brethren, for the people that I love and care about, that know God like I do, that believe that this is designed to get me somewhere? What do I want from you, and what do you want from me when we're going through that? And we're looking at four things today that deal with that. But understand, I do it out of love. Why? Because if you don't make it through the trial, you don't get to heaven. If I don't make it through the trial, I don't get to heaven. I lose the hope. I lose the crown of life. So if we love each other, if we're kind and tender-hearted, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, toward each other, then I want for you what? I want for you the crown of life. I want for you to make it. I want for you to have your hope realized. So if I love you, and that's my goal for you as it is for myself, then I'm going to be willing to do whatever it takes to help you get through trials. Because that's going to be necessary if we're going to ever find eternal life. All right, so Job chapter 2. Let's look at the first thing. It's hard to talk about trials, isn't it, without talking about Job. Look at Job chapter 2, and And we're familiar with the story of Job. I'm not going to go through all that. Job's lost everything, lost his family. He's now been stricken with boils. He's in just terrible shape. And as we think about Job, and he's held up in the Bible as being this example of patience, it's easy to overlook what has always been something that I've been amazed at in this book, and that's in Job chapter 2. In Job chapter 2, it's going to introduce this idea, the first thing that we want when we're going through a trial, the way we can show brotherly love in trial. So in Job chapter 2, Satan attacks him. He gets permission from God. He covers him with boils. In verse 8, he took a piece of broken pottery which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. That's the condition he's in. And we get to verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, Zophar, the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show sympathy and comfort to him. And I thought about what do we want to show during trial to our brothers? What do we need to get through the trial? The first thing is we need sympathy and comfort from each other. Now, you know, Job's three friends get a bad rap, and it's not undue, right? They kind of get on to Job, and they do some things that are really bad. But I'm going to tell you, don't mistake the fact that these three men love Job. And Job loved them. At the end of the book, when Job has a chance to let God really lay it to him for the wrong accusations they've made against him, Job prays on their behalf that they'd be forgiven by God, and he does. But look at the motivation. These men, despite what they end up saying about Job, they didn't go down there to blast Job. They didn't go down there thinking, we're really going to get Job. He always thought he was better than us. We're going to go nail him right now. No. And so as we think about what do I need to do to others, what do I need to help others with when they're going through trials, I need to watch my motive first, and I need to make sure that why I'm going is for comfort and sympathy. And so that's why these three men go. They made an appointment together to show him sympathy and comfort. That's all they go down there for. Why are we going to go down there and fix Job? We're going to fix his problems. We got some salve that we can put on his boils, and that's going to make him all better. No. You see, we don't go in what we don't often need first from people that come to us when we want to help each other in trials. We don't first need them to solve our problem. We first just need them to show us some comfort and sympathy. We need to show each other we love each other. And we're sorry for what you're going through. And that's what they did. And look what they do in verse 12. And they saw him from a distance. They did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept. And they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Would that we could be friends to each other that way when we're going to trial. One of the reasons people feel inadequate, and I talk to people all the time, they say, well, I don't know what to say. You know, I don't know the right words. Somebody has some great tragedy happen to them. They lose a child. They've been diagnosed with cancer. They've lost their job. You know, their house burned down. You can just think of all these things that would be big. You know, their friends have abandoned them. Whatever it is. And we often say, well, I just don't, you know, I'd call them, I'd go by there, but I just don't know what to say. And what we learn from this is just go show some sympathy and comfort. Just go sit there and put your hand on their leg or put your arm on their shoulder and say to them, I love you. And then shut up and sit down with them. Because frankly, sometimes that's all we want. I just want to know that you love me and care about me. I just want to know that you're not going to walk away from me because this bad thing has happened. I want to know that you understand on some level what I'm going through. I just want to be loved and shown comfort. I just want to be told you're sorry. I'll never forget, I got out of college and we started grew up at Lakeshore and started working at South Jacksonville. And some of you knew Harold Dowdy. And Harold Dowdy is one of those men in the Brotherhood that had a reputation and just kind of bigger than life. And I remember going there, you know, so I was 21 years old, and And we hadn't been there very long, and somebody in the congregation that we didn't even know, but everybody in the congregation was close to, died. And I'll never forget, so Harold gets up to preach, and they died like the day before. And here I am as a young man, I'm like, wow, I'm going to get to hear what Harold would say in a time like this. And I'm just trying to learn. And you know all he did? He got up, and he kind of hung his head and shook his head a little bit. I can see it right now in my mind. And he just said, and he called the family out or whatever and said, we're sorry. We're just terribly sorry for you right now. And we love you. And that's all he said. And it was so powerful. And I learned from that. It's not about flowery speeches. It's not about having the right exact word. Because let me tell you, what we all know is what? When I'm in the midst of something really bad, there's no word that's going to make it better. I've just been diagnosed with cancer. You can't fix that with a word. I need some love and comfort. Tell me that you love me. Sometimes it's just a gesture. Sometimes it's just a hug. You know who's good at that is Ann Mathis. There have been times when, you know, some people didn't know, or you can look at somebody, right, and they're just like, he's down right now. Bert's good at this too with me. But Ann's just like this, I think, with everybody. And you know what Ann will always say? Brother. And she'll hug you. I'll get emotional just thinking about that. And it's just that little, and I can hear her in my ear right now saying, oh, brother. Or, brother, I love you. And that's all she said. She didn't give you a long speech or anything like that. Bert will come up to me like that. When he sees me like that, sometimes he'll say, how you doing, brother? And I'm not looking for anything else. I wasn't looking for anything, actually. I was hoping nobody noticed. How you doing, brother? I'm sorry. I love you. That's all Job's friends did. They just sat there for a week and didn't say anything. Isn't that what we do? It's going to the hospital and sitting with somebody. You can't do anything, but you're there. Oh, I've learned this the hard way. I can remember Zachariah had a little opening on his neck when he was born, a brachial cleft cyst or something. Missy can tell you all about it. And I remember he had to have surgery. He was about a little over a year old or something like that. He had to get old enough to have it. And it was minor surgery. It was only going to take 20 minutes or something like that. But he had to go under, had to be at the hospital. So loving husband, young man, Daryl, thinks, well, that's no big deal. Missy can take care of that by herself. I'll just let her go. And I went to work. And she's at the hospital by herself with our only child, and he's having surgery. I know, I'm a heel, I admit it. That's why I've learned. But you know what? Harold and I think Marilyn Hardage, on their own, we didn't ask them. On their own, they just showed up and they sat with Missy. What love. What a small thing. But what? We recognize that. Why? Because time's valuable to us. We all know that. We all have a limited amount of time. And for Job's friends to go 7 days and sit with him showed that they loved him. For you to go sit with somebody for an hour, 2 hours, you make a meal. It's not there's not enough food there already. It's not they're going to starve. What is it? It's just, I don't know what to say. You're hurting. I love you. Eat some lasagna. It's those small things, right? And I don't have to always intrude for long periods of time. And sometimes it's those smallest things that matter the most. We got to move on. All right, so number one, and I didn't advance. I did all this on PowerPoint and I didn't even put it on here. Yeah, exactly. Resolve to show sympathy and comfort. All right, secondly, speak the truth in love. We all know that verse from Ephesians chapter 4, right? Speak the truth in love. Sometimes when trials come, we have this tendency with each other, and that is, okay, I just got to be pleasant. I can't say anything that might offend them, or I've got to be very careful. So sometimes when I go to help somebody in trials, it's better just to be quiet and not say anything. just show comfort and love. Other times we need to speak up. But sometimes what we don't do and what we shouldn't do is we shouldn't minimize what people are going through, and we shouldn't sugarcoat what they're going through. Look in Peter. There's just several places in Peter. 1 Peter chapter 2. We'll look at a couple verses there. 1 Peter, starting in chapter 2. Peter talks about trials all through this book. But in chapter 2, starting in verse 19, he says this: "For this is a gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrow while suffering unjustly." I mean, listen to that language. Do you understand when you suffer unjustly? And that can be a broad area, right? We can think all the way from persecution to you've been blamed for something you didn't do to you get some disease that you had no control over that you couldn't do anything about. There's just a lot of reasons. But he says, what? It's gracious to God. Now think about that. God looks at your suffering unjustly and He sees it as a gracious thing. He sees it as something good. That's how James can say, count it all joy. That's how Romans can say, you know, be appreciative of these things. All right? So when I suffer, mindful of God, and I endure sorrows for suffering unjustly, for doing what God would have me to do, he says that's a gracious thing in the sight of God. Now, but look at the contrast. Because see, not all trials are the same. So how I help somebody is going to be dependent on what the trial is. There's no one size fits all for this. And so he says in the next verse, verse 20, "For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure?" In other words, I'm not going to approach somebody who's suffering because they did wrong. And they're suffering because of it. And we're not helping anybody when we go to help somebody, because that suffering still has to be endured. It still has to be overcome if we're going to see a crown of life. But it's different than when I've suffered unjustly. So I don't have to come and say, well, you know, it's unfair that this has been done to you. It's unfair that you lost your job. I'm going to approach somebody differently when they lost their job because they've been stealing as compared to they got fired because they wouldn't steal. Or they lost their job because they can't get to work on time. Because they won't get up in the mornings. They're both suffering because of consequences. One is gracious in the eyes of God. The other is not spoken of that way. I can still show in both cases sympathy and comfort. But I'm going to speak the truth in love in both those cases. In one case, I'm going to say, you know that what you did caused this to happen to you. I'm not going to say that to the person who's suffering unjustly. So how I look at the trial, and that's the way he's trying to get us to see. We just don't say trials are the same and we treat everybody the same. No, I expect if I've done something and I'm suffering because I know what I've done, I expect you to come to me with some correction. Do it gently. Show me some sympathy and love. But correct me. I expect that. But I don't expect correction when I'm suffering like Job, when Job suffered for suffering for something I hadn't done. So how I approach it's going to be different. He goes on to say, "But if you do good and suffer for it, you endure. This is a gracious thing in the sight of God." That's verse, again, continuing in verse 20. "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in His steps." So here's Christ, an example of what kind of suffering? Unjust suffering. That's gracious in the sight of God. That's important. That's what we want. Now, look at chapter 4, starting in verse 12. He says it this way: "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you." When we go to somebody and they're suffering that way, unjustly, they're suffering because of the fiery trial, we don't have to tell them things like, it's all going to be okay. It won't last long. You know, don't worry about it. It's not that bad. We'd be better not saying anything. In fact, what are we supposed to be doing, according to James? We're supposed to be imparting wisdom. In fact, we might say, look, if you continue to stand for God the way you are, it's going to keep going. They're not going to stop. So we're not helping anybody when we sugarcoat it, quote, just to make them feel better. We need to go and speak the truth in love. We need to go, look what you're enduring right now. I can tell you from my experience, it's going to continue the rest of your life. So you might say that to what? A teenager who's struggling in school because he's lost some friends or he's been ridiculed because of his faith. You don't want to go to him and say, oh, don't worry, when you get out of high school, it'll never happen again. You don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about people making fun of you and not being your friends because you're a Christian. That's not true. See, we're not helping by just trying to, quote, make them feel better. What's true is, look, you're going to probably have to deal with this your whole life. But we're going to be there with you. And your brethren won't abandon you. You see, we do. I deal with that too. And there are other people at the congregation that deal with that too. And they suffer persecution and hardship in their jobs because they stand up for what's right. You can make it. It's okay. I love you, but it's not over. Speak the truth in love when we go to somebody. Okay, number three. This is a hard one for some people. Be vulnerable and share your experience. As many of you know, last spring, last year, it was kind of difficult early in the year when Micah had committed suicide, our drug overdose. And as we were dealing with that, I wrote about it in one of my reports. I shared, you know, the struggle that was. That's something that had never happened before, and you guys suffered in that too. But I had gotten a contribution before this from a lady, and I won't give her name, but she, and I only knew her through Abe. Abe had told her when Abe was still alive about the prison work, and so she sent some money here or there like that. I'd never met her, as far as I know. Wouldn't know if she was sitting in the building right now. But after she read my report, she wrote me a letter back, and it said, "Dear Mr. Townsend," and she's a sister in Christ, "encloses my check for $200. Okay, so that was nice, but I was very sorry to read about Micah Asbill. My prayers go out to his family and to you for all the good work you're doing. And I mean, if she had just stopped there, what has she done? She's shown me love and comfort. She doesn't know me really, but she appreciates me and what the work we're doing. And just saying, I thought about you enough to write this note to you, and I care. That would have been enough right there. But listen to what she says next. My son got into drugs when he was a teenager and later became an alcoholic. This went on for several years, and then he decided he would quit drinking, and that worked for several months. These were the best months we had for years. And then I found him in my garage early one morning where he had committed suicide. Abe said sometimes when alcoholics quit drinking, they don't fit into either world. After his death, two of his friends that were living somewhere else contacted me and said they had been heading in the wrong direction, but had their lives changed because they had found religion. That is why I know what you're doing is so important." And she signed her name. I don't know this lady from anybody. And she's going to tell me about her son committing suicide? Look at the risk you take when you're vulnerable. Look at the risk you take. Oh, if people know, if the brethren know about my son being an alcoholic and a drug addict, what are they going to think? Oh, she's a bad mother. If she'd have raised him right, that wouldn't have happened. And then he committed suicide. What kind of family was that? They're Christians. You can realize all that in your mind, and you can justify why when I love somebody and they're struggling with something and I could help, why it'd be better not to be vulnerable. But man, that has power. That was encouraging to me. And if you go in my office, this is right up there stuck to my wall to remind me. You see, we got to be vulnerable. Because if we don't share our experience with each other, then how are we going to really help each other? that's one of the things I appreciated so much about Jerry and Jenny from the very beginning. If you remember, from the very early on, they shared a very vulnerable time in their life. They talked about the loss of a child. We didn't need to know that. They could easily come here and work with us, and we could have never known about that if they'd have kept it quiet. What were they saying in that? They weren't asking us for help. They've been dealing with this now. And although it hurts now, it's not like it was then. No, what were they doing? They were saying, we're willing to be vulnerable with this group of people. We're willing to help you on any level it takes. And when we do that, you know what we're saying to other people? Will you be vulnerable with me? Will you share with me when you can help me? Will you share with me some of the things in your life that have hurt you the most? Because see, when you've gone through trials and you know the hurt and pain, you know when you have something that can really help somebody else. That's why everybody can't do this the same. Everybody can't be vulnerable at the same level. Everybody can't help each other the same way. When I was 20 years old, I couldn't help somebody like I can now. But are you willing to be vulnerable? Are we willing to share the suffering that we've all experienced? See, we can walk around and act like nothing bad's ever happened to me like that. But you know what? Most of us, if you've lived long enough on this earth, most of us have suffered similar to this. Not exactly. And hope to God, not that severely. But we know the pain of suffering. Will we share it with each other? See, will you come to me? Will I come to you and say, nobody else may know about this, but let me share this with you. Let me share with you what's been the biggest hurts in my life. Maybe it can help you. Why would we ever do that? Because I want them to have the crown of life. That's what it's all about, right? And if my suffering can help you work through this tragedy in your life, then why would I be so selfish as to not share it with you? I know it's scary. I know there's risk. People can use it against you. They can. They can look at you in a bad way from then on. But guess what? Look at the upside. The upside is their soul is saved. See, we don't see it that profoundly. We're like, oh, you know what? They'll get over it and it'll all be okay. Well, know what? We all know people that don't get over it. They don't ever fix it. They lose their soul over a trial. Will we be vulnerable? Will we share? Look over at Peter while we're there in 1 Peter chapter 5. Look what he says. He starts in verse 8 talking about the devil, the adversary, the devil prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Then he gets to verse 9, and look what he says in verse 9. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of sufferings are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. Why would Peter write that? Why didn't he just say, look, you just study your Bibles and continue to follow the Word and it'll all work out. And that's true on one level, right? But what does he do? He's saying, here's some comfort. Here's some wisdom for you. Here's some help you can get. Who do I get help from? Each other. Why? Because your brethren are suffering the same kind of circumstances all over this world. But what does Satan try to do? He tries to isolate us. He tries to tell us what? Nobody's ever suffered like I have. Nobody's ever hurt the way I hurt right now. Nobody's ever felt betrayed the way I feel betrayed now. Nobody's ever been as scared as I am right now. And he tries to make us think we're all by ourselves. And so what Peter says is, you're never by yourself. There are people in the family of God that have suffered the same way you have. And they've made it through, and you can gain wisdom. You can gain comfort. You can gain love. You can gain encouragement through them. But if we all sit back and we don't say anything about our own suffering, how's anybody going to know that we could help each other? Steve Truby, who some of you know, has gotten involved in the prison work. The way he got involved, and he still works a full-time job, Steve teaches every Sunday in a prison down there, has a class during the week one night, just gotten very involved, writes to a bunch of guys. He found out that a guy that he'd been, he called it my best friend in the church, he died. Steve's best friend in the church died. After he died, his widow tells Steve that he had a son in prison doing a life sentence. Steve never knew about it. Nobody in the church there knew about it. Why? He was afraid of what people would think about him. Look what he lost. He lost a chance for his brethren to come alongside him and say, it's okay. We love you anyway, and you have a son in prison. What can we do to encourage him? Steve started writing to him. He's gone down and visited him. That's what got Steve involved. But how sad that is, that we sit next to each other every Sunday and every Wednesday, and we're around bonfires together, and we're sitting in people's living room together, and we eat together, and we share our funds and our purpose together, and yet we won't share things, the hurts in our lives, because we're too vulnerable, we'll be exposed too much, and we don't get help, and we don't help each other. It's sad. And it's a tool of Satan. You see, one of the things you can think about, one of the victories in suffering and overcoming is what? That I can help somebody else. Maybe I can ease the suffering of somebody else that's going through this thing. All right, the last one. Don't avoid others who are suffering. Look at Ecclesiastes. Bert will know this is one of my favorite verses. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Starting in verse 2. Ecclesiastes 7, starting in verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind. And the living will lay at the heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of the face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. When you're going through trials, or you know somebody that's going through trials, don't avoid them. Because you're uncomfortable, you don't know what to say. Be around people that suffer. Isn't that what he's saying here? He says, better go to the house in the mourning. And I always apply this to funerals. I always go to a funeral, skip the wedding, go to the funeral. You'll get way more out of it. But what he says is, what happens sometimes, we know somebody's struggling deeply with something, we're uncomfortable with it, maybe we don't feel like we know what to say or we don't know how to approach them, and so what do? We just kind of shy away. If they sit on this side and we know, and there are a couple people that we're talking to, and we just kind of slip out this side so we don't have to really face them in that awkward moment because they just lost somebody they love or they're struggling, something bad, terrible has happened in their life, and we don't know what to say to them, so we avoid them. Don't avoid suffering. And if I'm the one suffering, don't isolate. Look, there's a time where you want to be alone, and I understand that. It doesn't mean I have to be around people all the time, but I know the difference between I just need a little time alone to the time, to more, it's, oh, I just go sit in the house with the lights off and just mourn over my situation. Or I just sit there blindly watching the TV alone in my room because I don't want to be around anybody because I hurt so bad. Don't avoid somebody that's suffering. Go and seek them out. You be the person, you be the one that's going to be there when they're suffering. You be the one that's going to help. You be the one that wants to encourage. Look, there's wisdom involved in that, and sometimes not knowing the right time to say it. It just takes practice in knowing when to intercede and when to say, no, you don't need to be alone right now. But the principle is the same. Don't avoid others who are suffering. Because we need each other. Because that suffering is temptation for them. That suffering could affect their eternal destination. Don't avoid them. Go after them. Let's go after each other as we suffer. Our time's passed up. If you're not a Christian today,